plastic surgery is not going to make their life better. It's not going to make them happy.
Hi, Kirby.
Hi, Sarah.
Welcome to Los Angeles.
Welcome, Glamgelinos.
We hope you stay a while.
Cute. That's cute.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Press and go. Just press and go.
That's
life's
our motto.
A show when you just press and go.
No, literally, that's our 2024 motto.
Just press and go.
We don't have time for glue. We need to just press and go.
Stop with the glue. Glue is so 2002.
Wow.
We're talking about impress, press on falsies, and press on manicure. The Impress Press-On Falsies are these lashes that require zero glue. They have a variety of different styles. I personally am a fan of the natural and also the wispies. I like applying a few just to the corner of my eyes. And honestly, this is faster for me than applying mascara. It is so quick. I gotta also tell you the falsies, one thing I forgot to mention, they're the underlash. It's underneath the lash. So they look super, super realistic. No glue, just press and go.
Speaking of press and go, let's talk about the Impress No Glue Manis that I am obsessed with. If you follow me, you know that I am in my press-on era right now because I do not have time to sit in the chair at the salon like many of you for like 2 hours. And that's fine because thanks to Impress, you can have a super fabulous mani in seconds. You don't have to apply any glue. They come in all different styles. And the Impress manicure has a patented super hold adhesive for up to 7 days.
If you want to try the no glue mani or press on falsies from Impress that won't damage your nails or lashes, just go to Impress. That's impressbeauty.com/Los Angeles. And then use our code Los Angeles to check out for 25% off Impress manicure and press on falsies. All right, everybody. New year, new you. For some people, that means getting some plastic surgery. And I'm not trying to say that, you know, casually. I think a plastic surgery decision is a big one. But there are lots of conversations around different types of surgeries you can get now. I think TikTok has been really explosive and kind of pulling back the curtain on what people are getting and what's out there, the dangers to some of these things, the benefits to doing some of these surgeries versus some injectables. And so I wanted, and Sarah wanted, to have Dr. Catherine Chang, or Kat Chang, on the pod today because she is somebody that we both trust, somebody that is well-respected within the plastics community. Dr. Samuelitis, a friend of the pod, is fully obsessed with Dr. Chang, and I actually had a consult with Dr. Chang a few weeks ago for a story. She treated me just like any client that would come in. It was very, very fascinating, especially as somebody who wants to learn more just about like your facial anatomy and how you age. And she was giving me some really interesting intel on that. So welcome to the podcast, Dr. Kat Chang.
Thank you so much for having me, Sarah and Kirby. So excited to be here.
And I do want to walk through your credentials because you didn't just decide to call yourself a doctor.
She earned them. We need to list every single thing out. She worked her ass off.
Yes, I fully agree with that. So Dr. Chang is a Harvard-trained plastic and reconstructive surgeon with a subspecialization in craniomaxillofacial aesthetic and reconstructive plastic surgery. Her specialties include a combination of both aesthetic and reconstructive procedures, like facial aesthetics, including the facelift, the neck lift, the mini facelift, which I'm going to talk about because she told me something really interesting about this. The revision facelift, which is wild, rhinoplasties,
eyelid rejuvenation, ear surgery, and the custom-designed facial implant surgery. Dr. Chang also specializes in reconstructive plastic surgery, which includes trauma and cancer reconstruction of the face and body. I absolutely love that. So you have a very well-rounded offering for your clientele.
Thank you. Yes, I try.
But the reason why we wanted Dr. Chang on is because she really does know the face so intimately. And I interviewed a lot of plastic surgeons for this story, people I love and respect, people that also know the face really well. And I was able to actually go in and see Dr. Chang because she is based here in LA. And Dr. Chang, do you mind telling us how old you are? Are you comfortable telling us that?
I am almost 40.
I wanted to bring this up because we are all the same age. We are all in that grouping of late 30s. And oftentimes when you talk to a lot of these plastic surgeons, they are significantly older than you. So it was, for me, really nice to speak to somebody that's like my same age. And I felt kind of like a kindred, a friendship with, almost being like, you are in our same age range of people our age, kind of thinking like, is it too soon to think about something like this? Is this something I should even be considering? What are the options? So it's like, you're a cool plastic surgeon. You're like, you're a hip plastic surgeon.
And I also get it. You know, I know what, you know, I'm seeing with age-related changes in myself and, you know, my patients, and I can really relate.
Totally.
Can I just ask a really quick question? Do your patients ever maybe question your credibility because you are so young?
Early on, that definitely happened a lot more often. Someone thought I was 17 and I was like, clearly that is not possible. I'm not Doogie Howser. But, you know, I think early on there was definitely a lot of concern about my age. But at this point, I really don't have any issues with that. The majority of my patients all come from referrals of patients who know my patients. And so, you know, I don't really hear that anymore. And I think it's also kind of shifted into, you look great for your age. What do you do? And so that is actually kind of been great.
Totally. When we were talking, she was showing me some of her clients before and afters. And she would say, oh, this was about 7 years ago. And I'm looking at her like, were you even practicing 7 years ago? Like, let's be for real. But not to minimize anything that you're doing, it's just, you do look so great. And
thank you.
I think a lot of people that come in to see you are thinking, okay, if this is how she looks, how can I achieve that? You know what I mean?
Thank you. You look great.
Thanks.
But I started young.
You did. So Dr. Chang, what's on your face? What are you loving right now? We want all the tea. Like, you see it all. You know about skin. You see underneath the skin, which we're going to talk about. What are your favorite things for your hair, skin, nails, all the things?
Yeah, I'll just kind of run you through what I do on a daily basis. And so for me, I also have sensitive skin. So keeping that in mind, there's a lot of products. I try a ton of products daily, but the ones that I use, you know, regularly and routinely are what I'm going to share with you. So when I wake up, I always start with washing my face. I use the Fresh Soy Cleanser. And for me, it's non-irritating. I never feel dry. And then after, I slap on my Nike Beauty under eye hydrogel masks. I leave them on for about 30 to 40 minutes. And while I'm doing that, I'll brush my teeth. I'll take care of things I need to do in the morning. I'll eat, answer emails, because you really want to let them sit. Then after that, I apply TNS from Skin Medica, which is my absolute favorite growth factor. And you have to let that sit for actually 8 minutes, which most people don't do. That's how long the actives last. And so if you apply things before the 8 minutes, you know, you don't really get the full effects. That being said, I don't have the most patience, so I'll apply the TNS and I'll try to do something else. In the meantime, I'll change and come back. And usually that's between like 3 to 5 minutes. And then I always put on an antioxidant. So whether or not it's a vitamin C, right now I'm using the Lumavive, also from TNS. And then on my skin, I'll apply just basic Cetaphil for my entire body. And then lastly, on my face, I will apply sunscreen. And I'm a big proponent of using mineral-based sunscreen. So currently I'm using an Elta sunscreen. They have many different types of mineral-based. I just have the sheer one on right now. And then on my body, I will also apply sunscreen. So the problem is I get into my car and you'll see just fingerprints all over my steering wheel and like the outside of my car because my hands are always covered in sunscreen. But I slather that on my entire body. And what's really important to make sure that people always forget is really getting the sunscreen on your face and neck and chest. So a lot of people forget that. And then they come into the office and you can see a clear demarcation where sunscreen was applied on the face and then the neck and chest. And you can see the outline typically of whatever top they're, you know, often wearing. And then routinely for the office, I'll just put on Thrive Cosmetics mascara, which I love. It's non-irritating. It doesn't flake for me, which is important because I don't like rubbing my eye during the day. That's my basic.
I was going to say, I'm sure you talked about, you know, the décolleté, making sure that you apply the sunscreen there. And I think it's important for someone like you to really advertise that. I think that we advocate a lot for that, but you're seeing people come in and they want facial rejuvenation and you're kind of going, well, I can do this to your face, but like, we also need to think about skincare for your neck. Like, are we getting lasers on your neck? Are we what are we doing to help kind of match this area to your face, which you probably run into a lot?
Yeah, all the time. So a lot of people do forget their neck and chest, like we just mentioned. But the problem is once the skin gets damaged, it's really hard to reverse it. So the best way to stay young and keep your skin looking healthy and young is to prevent any damage. And the best thing to do that is sunscreen. And so when people come in and they're concerned about the face, you know, I always address the neck and chest because that's something that is a continuation of the face. And the problem is once the neck, which is thinner skin than the face, so it gets damaged more quickly, it loses collagen and elasticity more quickly. So it definitely shows signs of aging more quickly than the face. And oftentimes people notice around their eyes and the neck first, because that's where the thinnest area of skin is. And so I definitely do often laser the neck simultaneously or even before or after surgery or face rejuvenation surgery.
Oh, I need that. I need it. Okay, Dr. Chang, let's back it up. Let's talk about how you got started. Let's talk about your background. You know, growing up, did you always know you wanted to be a doctor? Did you always want to be a plastic surgeon? Like, how did you fall into this path? And if so, was like Beverly Hills like always your goal?
Yeah, so that's a great question because my path is non-linear. And so I would say in my family, there are a lot of doctors and surgeons. My uncle's a neurosurgeon. My brother is an orthopedic surgeon. But I never wanted to be a doctor. You know, it wasn't something that I was always desiring. It was always in the back of my mind because I was interested in it. But in college, I dabbled in art history, business, biochemical engineering. And when I got into medical school, I actually was going to be a heart surgeon. That was like the thing I was going to do. I went on heart transplant runs, helped to harvest heart transplant runs as a medical student at like 2, 3 a.m. And that's what I wanted to do until, you know, one day I was doing a case. It was a reconstructive case. And a plastic surgeon came in and did this amazing bony reconstruction, taking bone from the leg, harvesting it along with the arteries, vessels, and nerves, and reconnecting it. And that was just such an amazing thing to see. And I didn't know that was a part of plastic surgery, which I think the majority of people don't recognize, which is the reconstructive aspect of plastic surgery, which is the majority of what our training is in. And so plastic surgeons are considered one of the original and one of the last standing general surgeons, because we operate literally from head to toe. We operate on the skin, the fat, the arteries and veins, nerves, hands, bone. And so no other specialty really does that, which is why our training is so long. And I was all about reconstructive surgery. That's what I was going to do. And then I started getting very interested in reconstructive craniofacial surgery, which is what a lot of my training was in. And it kind of tied back into when I was younger, and I was always just interested in the face. And, you know, I was also very interested in makeup as a young child. And my best friend, when I was 11, gave me the Kevin O'Quan makeup book, which was like the gold standard of makeup. And it was just really interesting to see what makeup could accomplish by looking at certain aspects of the face and where the arch of the brow should be, or if you have a full face, how do you slim it with makeup? And if you want to highlight certain areas, what you do with makeup. That to me was just very interesting and something that I think kind of was always in the back of my head. And additionally, growing up, I was a concert pianist. I actually performed at Carnegie Hall. And so I think I had a lot of dexterity to my fingers, which translated a lot into my kind of technical ability in plastic surgery. And so doing a lot of reconstructive plastic surgery and doing a lot of facial recon. So I did a lot of like gunshots to the face, where the face was completely, essentially the whole front of the face was blown off. And how do you reconstruct it? So you have to reconstruct the bone, you have to reconstruct the whole cranial facial skeleton, in addition to making it look aesthetic, because nobody wants to walk around looking, you know, just put together without having, you know, aesthetic reconstructive aspect to it. So that's kind of what transitioned me into facial aesthetics. And I was always on the East Coast. And the reason I came to the West Coast is because I love to surf. So I never thought I'd end up in Beverly Hills, not anything that I was ever thinking or dreaming I would end up in, but just so happened to end up here. And I do try to surf every week if I can.
I just have to say that you're like the dream Asian daughter, concert pianist, doctor, and then your brother's a doctor. My God, your parents must be so proud.
Actually.
And on top of that, a very perfect human. Beautiful, smart, sporty.
Yeah. Well-rounded.
Yeah. Very well-rounded. Yeah.
Well-spoken.
Ideal college applicant. Love this.
You are too sweet, but it's the opposite. My mom literally called me not too long ago, maybe 6 months ago. And she was like, oh, I'm feeling, you know, she wasn't feeling well. She had some derm issue on her skin and some cough. And I was like, oh, well, I was like, you should see your primary care doctor. And then she's like, you know, you and your brother are just useless. You know, I have these questions and I thought you could answer them. And we send your, like, you know, go to your prime PCP. So I don't know.
Wow. Really typical Asian parents then. Typical
you
Asian parents.
You cannot please everyone.
Yes, you definitely can't please everyone.
Well, we're proud of you, Dr. Chang.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah.
We are. We're so proud of you. So, okay, Dr. Chang, I want to know, well, okay, first of all, just going back to the reconstructive surgery of it all, this is why I love doing this podcast, because I hope that more people now start to think of plastic surgeons in a different light. Because I think it's really easy to say it's superficial. They're doing boob jobs and facelifts. They're like this unattainable idea of beauty, all of these things. Like, I mean, and we hear it too. Like, we had Kat Sadler on talking about her facelift. We got some pushback from people saying, I stopped listening after this. These are beauty standards I don't want to live up to. And that's totally fine. But for me, I think that hearing about the reconstruction of it all and how technically skilled you have to be able to put somebody's face back together after something so traumatic, like a gunshot wound to the face, that's incredible. I just kept thinking while you were talking, I am so anxious even thinking about trying to figure that out. And I know you've had very, you know, great training and you're very skilled at it, but I can't even begin to think about how much time, energy, and like emotional investment you probably have in doing these things.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, these cases are incredibly difficult to deal with, both from a technical aspect, but also the emotional aspect. And sometimes these are, you know, assaults, you know, on the face. And sometimes these are self-inflicted. And, you know, you're not just taking care of the wounds, you're taking care of the patient as a whole. So there's definitely that emotional aspect. And that also translates into, you know, aesthetic surgery, where you're not truly just taking care of what you're seeing, right? You're also counseling the patient on, you know, more of the emotional aspect of things. You hit the nail on the head for sure.
Wow. So let's kind of focus back on plastic surgery. I love learning about trends. And, you know, we're now in 2024, 2023 is behind us. I'm curious, what were you seeing your patients coming in and asking for more of? And can you tie that to anything like social media or they're like, oh, well, my friends are all doing this. Like, I'm really curious.
Or like a specific celebrity that, you know, people yeah. have been asking about.
Yeah. And also, Dr. Chang, will you share what your demo is for your practice for the most part?
My demo here is, I would say, 70% female, 30% males. The age range really varies, but I would say between mid-20s to my oldest patient's probably 97. And she's amazing. She's so healthy and just wants to look her best, and she looks awesome. And so in terms of trends that I was seeing the past couple of years, I would say, and especially the last year, there's been a trend towards looking more natural. That's always been something that, as you know me, is always something I've advocated for. It's something that I'm not like a trendy plastic surgeon, meaning I don't just do procedures based on trends. And I think that's really important because I think that natural beauty is always in fashion. It is always in style, and trends aren't, you know? And so a lot of this year, we see a lot of reversals of certain procedures that were really popular over the past 5 to 10 years. So we see a lot of reductions in BBLs, a lot of downsizing of breast implants, even complete removal of breast implants and instead fat grafting to the breast, which, you know, does look more natural than an implant. And in terms of, I would say kind of 2020 on, pandemic on, I think a lot of people were seeing different sides of their face when they were on all these Zoom calls that they just never saw. And they would come in saying, I never knew I looked like this from the side, you know, caught me by surprise and now I can't stop staring at it. Or I never saw my eyes, you know, look like this. And so there's definitely an uptick, I think, in facial plastic surgery. And that includes eyelid lifts, brow lifts, face and neck lifts, and definitely chin and jaw contouring. So chin implants or jaw implants.
Do people bring in a specific celebrity for the jaw and chin? I have someone in mind, but I'm wondering who they bring to you.
You know, I will say that early on, maybe 8+ years ago in my practice, I was seeing more of that. But nowadays, it's less common. You know, I think a lot of people, which I love, you know, I think a lot of people are like, this is what I look like, and I want to improve this aspect, or this is the aspect that bothers me. So I'm not seeing as much of this. I love how this celebrity looks. This is what I want. Sometimes you still see that, you know, you see, I like, this guy has a very strong jaw, and these are the aspects I like. And oftentimes people bring in multiple images, but I'm not seeing that as much, which I think is great.
Are people bringing in photos of themselves, like from, you know, earlier in their lives?
So I actually, for all my facial rejuvenation patients, ask them to bring in photos of when they were younger. So 20s, 30s, 40s, depending on what age they are. I do want to see one photo from one decade of their life. And I like to see how their face has changed. And I like to ask the patient, do you even like how you looked when you were 20 or 30 or 40? And oftentimes, what I think will be surprising to most people is that a lot of people like how they look in their 30s and 40s more than their 20s. So I'll have patients say, here's a photo from my mid-20s, but I really don't like this aspect, or I don't really like how full my face was or something. And I think that's kind of nice. You know, patients really are growing into their faces.
And Sarah, you and I are 3 steps ahead because as beauty editors, we have so many shots of our face from the front and from the side through all of our career. So when Dr. Chang asked for mine, I was like, please hold. I have many.
You're like, what specific angle, what lighting? Yeah.
You're going to see my jawline for the last 15 years. Don't you worry. So
it's kind of
funny to think about. But, you know, Dr. Chang, I love that you touched on that people aren't bringing in a celebrity photo and going, I want to look like Angelina Jolie, or I want to look like Margot Robbie. I mean, I would love to look like Margot Robbie, but like they're not saying I want to look identical to this person. Sarah, it kind of reminds me of what we talked about in terms of looking back on 2023 trends, the food trend. When it comes to makeup and nails and stuff like that, instead of people going in and saying, or even hair color, that's the point I'm trying to make. Instead of people going in and going, I want to have Margot Robbie's hair color, they're going in and saying, I want the vanilla creme brulee highlight, whatever. But it's a way to see, you know, ask for something that they like without having to say, I want to look exactly like this particular person. So in a way, those really random, bizarrely long hair color names are really beneficial. Look at us.
And then all the makeup trends, they're really just trying to ask to look like Hailey Bieber is really what they're trying to say.
Basically, that's what they're trying to say. So that's like the point for the makeup trend is I want to look like Hailey Bieber or Bella Hadid. That's it.
It's all inspired from someone.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about, speaking of, you know, how our face changes over the years. Obviously, we both have started to notice a lot of different changes in our faces. Maybe, you know, some for the better, some maybe not for the better. I don't want to say worse. But in general, what would you say do women start to notice change in their faces in their 30s and 40s?
I would step back and start in their 20s, because I would say most women start to notice around the eyes in the 20s. So they start to feel like they're seeing a little bit of lateral hooding of the eyelid. They're seeing some more smile lines around the eyes. And oftentimes women will say, I can't do my eyeliner the same anymore. Like, I can't wing it out because there's excess hooding. And so that's kind of the first thing that I see. Then in the 30s, I think what I start to see are twofold. And one is the cheeks feel like they're coming down a little bit. And people don't always say that though, but what they'll say are symptoms of that, which are, I feel like this area is looking hollow, or I'm starting to see fullness here. I'm seeing fullness kind of right around the corners of the mouth. And those are all symptoms of volume deflation, as well as descent of soft tissue. So when the cheeks start to come down, which unfortunately happens to all of us starting in our mid-30s, I would say, this, what's called the lid-cheek junction, gets longer. So if you take a look, closely look at people as they age, this distance gets longer, which makes the cheek look lower as well, but also makes this area look more hollow and less full. And that's why at this time, people will go in for non-surgical treatments and they'll put filler in, because it tends to look rejuvenating because it helps to solve some of the issues with volume loss. And so I'm not a proponent of filler. I'm not saying that's what we should do, but I think that's why when people do it, they're like, oh, it actually looks really good. And so when we start to see volume loss here, the cheek starts to come down, which then leads to accumulation of some soft tissue around the mouth. And then sometimes people start to see some early jowling around the jawline. And they don't say that though. What they'll say is, my jawline doesn't look as sharp as it used to, or it looks more square. It doesn't have that kind of V shape as much to it. And that kind of progresses into the early mid 40s, and you kind of see exacerbation of those early signs.
I'm smiling because this was my consultation. I was like, I keep pushing my skin up around my jawline, and then I feel like there's a dip here, and then this area is lower. And Dr. Chang, I've talked about this on the podcast, I don't know when, but I kept noticing that celebrities in their photos online had these little pinched faces. Like, all of a sudden their face looked really short. It looked like little baby face. And I was like, they are editing their faces to look like they did when they were children, where everything was a little bit moved up. It wasn't as elongated. And I was calling it the pinched face. And you put it perfectly. The reason why, it's almost like if we could pinch our faces, it would be great because it would help kind of bring everything back to where it was. And you wouldn't have the elongation of like the cheek, the hollowness under the eyes, the pre-jowl. What was the term you gave me when I was talking about my...
The marionettes.
Yeah, the marionettes. But you said... You were saying it was like the pre-jowl.
Pre-jowl sulcus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pre-jowl sulcus. That's the bane of my existence right now. I was like, I've never disliked a word more. The sulcus. Hate the sulcus. But no, it is really interesting. You said you don't like filler, or you're not a proponent of filler.
I'm not a big proponent of filler. No.
Okay. I think that this has been a trend in 2023 specifically, where we are seeing way more headlines and way more people going, I'm scared of filler. There's filler migration. I feel like I just look puffy. And they're turning, instead of to this filler injectable, to actual surgery to remedy these things. You see under the skin. So you're able to see, is filler actually dissolving as it claims? Is it moving around? Can you talk to us a little bit about what you're seeing when you go in for a facelift and what filler is doing to some of your patients?
Yeah. And so the reason I'm not a big fan of filler is that I think we're seeing a lot of downstream consequences of filler, causing scar tissue, filler migration, and especially in the under eye area. You know, you can see the Tyndall effect, where you see some blue hues under the skin. And also it's causing, filler brings water in. So a lot of people are getting puffiness around the eyes. And, you know, that's really hard to treat once you have that. You can always dissolve filler, but it's really hard to get rid of filler. completely. And so patients will say, oh, I haven't had filler for 5 years, but I'll go into the face, I'll see it, you know, and it's oftentimes in places that they said it wasn't placed in. And so when I'm underneath the skin and the SMAS, filler can be placed at different levels. And I think appropriately placed filler, I'm not seeing as many issues from that. But now you have a ton of different people who are injecting, some people who probably shouldn't be injecting, and they're placing filler in the wrong planes. And if you're placing filler in a gliding plane, so in the face, there are many layers of the face. And when you operate, you want to operate in the glide planes and you want to lift in the glide planes, meaning natural separations of the tissue and fascia, so that when you lift, first of all, it's bloodless, it's less traumatizing to the skin, things just glide. And when filler is placed in these glide planes, filler can travel. And additionally, filler can cause scar tissue. So when I get in there and I'm trying to do a lift, and typically, you know, this is a easy bloodless dissection, you can just place your finger in to sweep the glide planes apart, it's stuck, it's rock hard, there's been filler in there, which has caused scar tissue. And sometimes it affects the lift, meaning sometimes the scar tissue is so severe that you can't really move the glide planes. So you can't get as good of a lift as you want. Sometimes it's just annoying. You know, the filler's in the way. You open the SMAS, which is one of the deeper layers. I do a deep plane facelift, so I'm lifting the SMAS up. And when you lift the SMAS up, sometimes the filler just kind of spills out. And that part isn't more than just annoying, because the electric cautery that you're using doesn't work well with going through filler. And so it just adds a little bit more time to the case.
Wow.
Wow.
They were too stunned to speak. So there are people listening, myself included, that have had filler. And I spoke to the plastic surgeons for this particular story. And I said, I'm a little scared. I don't think I've overdone it with filler, but I've had filler. And I see Dr. Samuelitis to get those injections. She's the only person I trust to do them.
She's awesome. Love her.
What should I be doing? Like, do I need to go and like try to get that stuff dissolved? And for the most part, people were like, if you're not getting it regularly, I think you're fine. Just don't go crazy. But in your expert opinion, like, what are your thoughts? If, like me, you're thinking, okay, I've had filler and now I'm not really sure what to do.
I think a little bit of filler is fine. You know, and I think filler that is appropriately placed with somebody who knows what they're doing and is placing it in the right planes is fine. So I don't think there's an issue with doing filler. I don't think you need to go and get it dissolved right now. I think there's an issue when you're consistently and routinely placing a lot of filler, a lot of boluses in one session over a short period of time. This isn't my patient population, but I've seen patients who go in for filler every 3 to 6 months and they're putting a lot in. And I think it's really important for the provider at that point to say, you know, you need to stop. And I think that's where things can go overboard. And something else that I really dislike, which I see all the time in facelifts, which does affect the surgery, are threads. And threads are just, I know a lot of people like them, but if you think about it, you're placing something blindly under the skin with somebody who has never even been underneath the skin and in the face. And the problem is, essentially, when you place a thread, you're just sticking a needle in with, or a cannula in with the thread, and you're hoping that you're catching it at the right spot and lifting it at the right area in the right vector. And when people do that, they're causing a ton of scar tissue. And threads really last 4-6 weeks to maybe 3 to 6 months. And people then are routinely going back, you know, because they want to keep getting that lift. But it's just causing a lot of scar tissue underneath the skin, underneath the SMAS. And I just last week went into a facelift. My patient didn't tell me they had threading. I opened the face and my scissors would not cut. And I was surprised. I was like, wow, this is interesting, because this person told me they'd never had any threading, and my scissors actually got dull from the case because there was so much scar tissue. And afterwards I spoke with the patient and I was just telling them about, you know, what I encountered. And I asked them, I was like, have you ever had any threading? And she was like, oh, I totally forgot to tell you. I used to do a ton of threading. And so it's just important to really be honest, and I don't think that was willfully neglected. It's just they forgot. But it's important to really tell your plastic surgeon, just so you know, you have an idea of what you're getting into. It affects the length of time of the operation as well. I think one or two threads isn't a big deal, but when you're doing it every 3 to 6 months, you can cause a lot of trauma to the soft tissue underneath.
Oh my God. I feel like that's like when the doctor asks you how many drinks you have a week.
Yeah.
This person just forgot that they right. used to get threads all the time. Like, nope, yeah. sorry, I'm going to see it all. That's right. crazy. Wow. Never lie to Dr. Chang. She will figure it out.
I will. And I will ask you about it afterwards.
She's literally opening up your face. Like, she's going to know.
She knows you inside and out. Okay, so we know your thoughts on threads. We know your thoughts on filler. Let's talk about other injectables. Do you have a preference? You know, Botox, Dysport. What do you like?
I actually really like Botox. And so there's different types of neuromodulators, Botox, Dysport, Xeomin, and they all act differently to prevent muscle contraction. I actually was part of one of the first randomized prospective controlled studies that looked at Botox, Dysport, and Xeomin. And what our study found was that Botox tends to, number one, work a little faster at around 3 days. Dysport's pretty close too. But what we found, which is most important, is that in the cohort, there was more consistency amongst Botox. So the majority of patients that received Botox got the actual effect, as opposed to, you know, we found that Xeomin didn't get the actual effect. There was a larger variation of people that responded well and didn't respond well. And then for me, Botox, I'm a very precise person. I like things to stay where I put it. And so, you know, Dysport has a little bit of this spreading action, which some people like, because if you put it around the crow's feet, you might only need one injection as opposed to Botox, where you have to do multiple injections to get the area. But sometimes you can get spreading into areas you don't like. And so I like Botox personally. What I don't like, injectable-wise, is Kybella. And so a lot of patients will say, oh, I've had Kybella injections, or I'm coming in for this. Should I get Kybella? And I will always say no, because oftentimes Kybella, similarly to what we just talked about, causes a lot of scar tissue. And if you're hoping that an injection to remove fat will just stay where you place it, you know, I think you're hoping for a lot of things, as opposed to if you were to directly liposuction it, which will be more accurate, you can contour it exactly as you like, as opposed to injecting it in certain spots and hoping the enzyme works consistently throughout the whole area. Additionally, Kybella is painful. A lot of people get a lot of swelling underneath for a long time. And I actually think the swelling after Kybella is longer than just doing liposuction under there.
What are your thoughts on Sculptra? Sculptra, it's a dermal filler, right? So many are like, but it's not filler. But it is a dermal filler. It's a dermal filler.
Yeah, so it's not the traditional way of thinking about filler, in the sense that when you think about filler, which there's many types, but mostly today people are using hyaluronic acid-based fillers, which are dissolvable. You're placing something in and there's a volume to it. And then there's a compressibility aspect to filler. So different fillers have different abilities to lift depending on something called G prime, which is how much the filler can resist compression. So filler in certain areas where you don't want it to be compressed, or like the cheeks or the chin, the jaw. Sculptra is a little different. So Sculptra is polylactic acid. It's essentially a mixture that you're injecting. It gets absorbed by the body, and then the body builds collagen. And so it's not the traditional form, you know, of a filler in that sense, but it does help to create fullness after some time. And there's a lot of plastic surgeons that really don't like Sculptra because they think it causes a lot of scar tissue in certain areas. I think Sculptra placed in the right areas is fine. So I currently have a little Sculptra in my temples. I think some people have placed it along the jawline. I don't think it's going to be as effective as putting a filler with a high G prime, but I think it's fine to place there. Sculptra was initially used in HIV patients who had a lot of lipodystrophy, meaning a lot of soft tissue loss in their face where they looked very thin and cachectic. And Sculptra was used in those patients to help build volume back to the face. And so now we're using it aesthetically to also build volume in the face. I think when placing in the cheek area here, you can get some scar tissue. And sometimes if too much Sculptra is placed or too often, sometimes patients can get too much fullness. So I think that's kind of the controversy surrounding Sculptra.
Okay, one more question on what your thoughts are. What about SkinVive, the injectable moisturizer that everyone is talking about and trying and raving for now?
No, like people literally, it's like we were at a lunch at the Beverly Hills Hotel and people were coming up to me going, hey, do you want skin beef? I can get you skin beef.
Really? Who? Like random people?
like germs and like professionals that were there. Yeah. Like being like, have you tried skin beef? Like I'm like getting like texts from people like, hey, if you want to come in and try skin beef. And I'm like very devoted to Dr. Samuelitis. So
I also like, I don't want to be first in something.
No, and I'm scared.
I need to know how this is going to, you know, look in a few months. But tell us what your thoughts are on skin beef.
Yeah, I actually love that. And I also do not like testing things on my patients. So before I bring anything into the office, I number one, test on myself. And I also wait to see if there's any negative effects or any downstream consequences. And so I'm still waiting to bring it into the office. But the goal of SkinVeev is to act as a skin hydrator. So as opposed to a filler that's providing volume, the goal was to be similar to something that's available in Europe, which is something called Profilo, which is also a skin hydrator. And there, I think we're going to see as technology continues to develop an increase in availability of fillers like that, where they're more hydrators. And the reason it's really important is that if you look at crepey neck skin, I can lift the skin and I can tighten the skin, but what I can't do is I can't change the skin quality. So I always say it's surgery is like giving me a piece of fabric, asking me to make a jacket. I can make a jacket. I can't change the fabric. So I can lift, I can manipulate the skin, the fabric, the soft tissue, lift it into position, excise excess soft tissue, but I can't change that actual fundamental quality. And the way you change quality are through things like doing retinols, which increase collagen production, and radio frequency, lasers, they all help to build collagen and elasticity. And so the goal of SkinVeev is to hydrate the skin and to, from the inside, help to thicken the dermis of the skin or the thickness of the skin so it's not as crepey. And so we're going to see, you know, how it does. I think it's great that it's available. And I think we're going to see many versions as the year goes on.
Fascinating. I love learning about this stuff.
I'm going to wait till Dr. Chang gives us the green light, though.
Let us know.
I will.
Give us the intel. Okay. So let's talk about a facelift. I love seeing before and afters of facelifts. And Dr. Chang, when I went in for my consult for this story, showed me so many of her past patients that received this rejuvenation. Some of them, you know, 50s, some of them 40s, some even in their late 30s. And the thing that I thought was really interesting was that the woman in her late 30s before the one patient looked older than a patient in her early 50s before. And so it gets down to the question of, is there a perfect age for a facelift? I think everybody listening probably could deduce no, because it depends on the particular patient. But, you know, the story is kind of thinking of, okay, but what are some things we should be considering? Like, when are you the right candidate? Dr. Chang, do you want to walk us through some things that we can be thinking about at home and how we should kind of maybe shift our perspective of, you know, this is not your grandmother's facelift from the early 90s anymore. Like your clientele has gotten significantly younger, right? It's not like people in their 60s and 70s. It's more people in their 40s and 50s.
That's a great question. Something I get all the time, which is, what age makes me a candidate for a facelift, or when should I be getting a facelift? And exactly like you said, Kirby, which is something we discussed also, you know, at your consultation, which there is no perfect age for a facelift. So the perfect time for a facelift is when on physical exam, there's enough laxity for me to give you a lift and keeping your scars looking great. Because if you do it too early and there's too much tension, you'll have thickening or widening of your scars. So you have to be on physical exam a candidate for the procedure. I think you also, though, have to be emotionally and mentally ready and prepared to go through the process. So even if someone is a candidate for the lift on physical exam, but they're not ready in the right mental headspace, I let them know that. And I'll tell them, I don't think you're ready because of these reasons. And that's something I discuss with them during the consultation. There's also, and like you said, with just genetics, like that patient in the 30s, definitely had more laxity than some of my patients in their 50s. And so I think there's a lot of stigma still around facelifting, and I think it's getting better though. But, you know, that patient had seen other plastic surgeons and their friends and family were saying, oh, you don't need it. But on exam, she really had more laxity. And that's just something that is most likely due to genetics. It can be due to also just diet and environment and taking care of the skin, but mostly genetics, especially at that young age. And so going through the process, you know, a lot of people have to be ready that they're going to see a change. It's going to be immediate, but there's also the swelling aspect to it. And my patients, I think I'm well known for getting my patients back on their feet quicker with a short recovery time, but there's still a recovery time to it. And you have to understand that while the general trend of the swelling goes down like this, is not just down like this, there's kind of this up and down where certain days you're going to swell more than others. And so being able to be mentally ready, emotionally ready, having a good support system in place, and being a candidate on physical exam are what makes you a candidate in my hands.
Do you work with a therapist or a psychologist? Like, how do you make that judgment call? Because that's like another whole job for you.
Yes, that's a great question. I don't work with someone directly. If I think there's truly something that needs to be addressed, I do let them know. But that is another component of my job that's really important, which is determining who's the right patient to go through this procedure. So even if somebody is a candidate, but I think they're just not in a good space, or I think they'll never be in a good space because of just who they are, I let them know and I don't take people on. So oftentimes, and my team knows this, there's a heavy screening process to get into my office. There's a screening process first when you call. There's another phone call before you can even get to me to see me in the office. And that call is done by my team where they ask you a lot of questions. They go through what really you're looking for. And you also have to be doing it for the right reasons. So if somebody says to me, I'm doing this because I want to get this person back in my life, or I'm doing this because I think this will land me this job or this role, I will not operate because I think that's just a recipe for failure. And so the impetus and the reasons also have to be in line.
Every plastic surgeon that I have ever interviewed about getting some type of major surgery has said that the emotional element is probably most important for them. Obviously, making sure that they are actually physically a candidate is very important, and making sure that their health is in the right place as well. And they go through screenings for that, obviously. But the emotional element, a lot of them said, and I feel like this is what you're getting at too, is you have to keep in perspective that you're not going to get this surgery and you're going to look perfect and your life is going to be perfect. That's not what's going to happen here. Sarah and I actually have a friend who got two cosmetic procedures in the last year. I talk a lot about plastic surgery and those things on my Instagram story. And she wrote me and she said, hey, before you ever think about doing anything, I want to talk to you because there's an emotional element that you are probably not thinking about that happens. I'm very happy I did these things and I feel I look better. But in the initial afterwards swollenness, you are going through all of these phases thinking, did I make the wrong decision? It's like, truly, do you have the emotional capacity to take this on?
Exactly.
The other part of it too is for you, like being the professional, you're getting all these little red flags from people where you're thinking, okay, they definitely are a candidate for this, but like, are they going to make my life worse after the fact when it's not up to their standards and it's not perfect? A lot of people think of plastic surgery as a way to achieve greatness, perfection, all of those things. But getting a surgery like that, that maybe you've wanted, and maybe you are doing it for you, it's not going to completely change your entire life. It might benefit you in many ways, but if you're trying to like repair something with a plastic surgery, that's not what's going to happen.
100%. So I always say you can't, an unhappy person before surgery will be an unhappy person after surgery. So plastic surgery is not going to make their life better. It's not going to make them happy. And that is, you hit the nail on the head completely with that. And I think there's also the aspect of the emotional roller coaster, which you mentioned, which I actually give my patients a handout. And it says, the first couple of days, you are going to heavily question your judgment, you know, and whether or not you should have done this. And it goes through the whole process of over the span of 4 weeks, what to expect. And some people never go through it, actually. But oftentimes, a lot of people go through that.
So do you suggest people to maybe have considered a facelift for make 6 months to a year? Like, is there a timeline or You know what I mean? To sort of like really prepare themselves.
The consultation to me is like a date. So on this date, I'm assessing whether or not I want to have this relationship with you, because it is a long-term relationship. Once you've selected your surgeon, it's not just you have the surgery and you're gone. You're going to see me a lot. We're going to be talking a lot, and you're going to probably be seeing me for years. And so the patient is also, both of us are on a date where the patient's determining, is this the right person for me? Number one, are our values in line? If something happens, is this the person I want taking care of me? If something happens, is this person going to be even responsive? And, you know, on my side, I'm thinking, oh, is this person going to be able to handle the surgery, the emotional aspect of the surgery? And so oftentimes, you know, for me, like I said, there's a screening process in my office. And so by the time people get to me, they are ready. You know, so I don't typically, most people have been thinking about it for some time. It's not that they just thought about it and land in my office. So I don't think there's an exact timeline of you should be thinking about it for 3 to 6 months, but I think it's something that research is important. Looking at before and afters is important. Knowing what you want is important, and understanding that there's not perfection. So going back to that unhappy patient, you can do the most perfect surgery, and it could be on a before and after where the majority of people love the result, but that person could be the most miserable person. And that ties into whether or not somebody's a good candidate for surgery.
Totally. I believe you actually gave me a quote like that. Like, you can hit the A+, 110%, you knocked it out of the park. And then some people will have, this isn't like the same level, or I thought it was going to be tighter, or, you know, whatever it is. There's always going to be somebody that kind of nitpicks. And those people are the people that generally I think plastic surgeons don't want to work on. They're like,
yeah,
I went to school for this. I'm very busy. I need you to have like realistic expectations.
Right. And realistic is so important because, like I said, the inability of surgery to change quality of skin, and that's a discussion I have, and Kirby, we spoke about that before, but that discussion is really important. And it's also important for the patient to have the capacity to understand, because if you go in thinking that your skin will never be crepey again after the surgery, you will be heavily disappointed. And so that discussion is happens during the consultation, and that really helps me to determine whether or not someone's a good candidate.
Totally.
All right, Dr. Chang, you have spoken on some things that you do not like, that you do not advise to your patients, but let's give our listeners like a quick list. What are the things that Dr. Chang does not like to advise to her patients?
So things that I do not want my patients putting in their face, number one are threats. I think they are painful. They do not last long, 4 weeks to 6 months max, and they cause a ton of scar tissue in the face. It can also cause puckering, and the scar tissue will cause irregularity in the face. And if you are ever considering surgical facial rejuvenation down the road, it will make it much more difficult for your plastic surgeon and potentially cause your result to not be as effective or as good as it could be had you not done threading. The other thing would be overdoing your filler. So again, overdoing your filler, putting too much in, putting it in the wrong planes can cause a lot of scar tissue in the face. It can cause a lot of swelling to the face. If you do end up dissolving filler sometimes because of overexpansion of the soft tissue and the skin from putting too much filler in, you can get laxity in the face. And again, causing scar tissue for your plastic surgeon should you decide to go down a surgical route in the future can be annoying for your plastic surgeon, but also annoying for you because result may not be as good. So lastly, Kybella. I am not a fan of Kybella. It causes, I think, again, a lot of scar tissue. Kybella doesn't work evenly, and it also can cause a lot of irritation and swelling underneath the chin and in the submental region. And oftentimes, this amount of swelling is more than you would get with surgical swelling and also less precise. So threads, Kybella, overdoing your filler are three things I do not recommend.
Perfect sound bites. We adore you, Dr. Chang. You were so informative. I learned so much.
Oh my God, same.
Even more than I had already learned from you. Just teaching me every single time. Dr. Chang, like I said, was a source for this Allure story. Is there a perfect age for a facelift? If you want, go read the whole thing. I think it's personally fascinating. But Dr. Chang, where can everybody find you if they want to try to come see you for a consult? What's that process like? Please walk us through it.
Yes. So I am in Beverly Hills. And in order to get a consultation, you have to send in a request or call the office. So you can either schedule a consultation through the website, through our schedule a consultation form, or you can find that also on my Instagram, which is KatChangMD. And then through that, we'll walk you through the process. I have a concierge team that goes through what you should expect, what you're looking for. We help to guide you into the right procedures, because sometimes you might think you need a certain procedure to achieve your goal, but that's not actually the right procedure for you. And so we'll have a very honest and open discussion about what's needed to help you achieve your results. And that's where you'll find me.
Amazing. Thank you, Dr. Chang.
Thank you, Dr. Chang.
Thank you so much for having me, Sarah and Kirby.
All right, that's it. Thank you everyone for listening. We will be back on Tuesday with the week's most buzzy beauty news.
Make sure you subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Spotify so you don't miss any breaking beauty news or product reviews. And if you want to support us, be sure to follow us at Gloss Angeles Pod on all platforms and join our Facebook group.
Plus, find every product we recommend on our website, glossangelespod.com, as well as links to the stories and news we report each week. You can follow us, your hosts. I'm Sarah Tan, that's S-A-R-A-T-A-N, on all social platforms.
And I'm Kirby Johnson, K-I-R-B-I-E, on all social platforms.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.